Welcome to today's Indiana Chamber of Commerce Policy Issue Conference Call, hosted by Mr. Tom Schuman. During the presentation, all lines will be in a listen-only mode. If you have a question at any point during today's presentation, please press star 1. Again, to ask a question, press star 1 at any time. Thank you all for your attention. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Mr. Tom Schuman.
Good morning and welcome to our first of two April policy calls. We say that because we'll be back on the last day of the month with a wrap-up of the 2019 Indiana General Assembly session. We'll get to that a little bit later, but today we have our entire, your entire Indiana Chamber advocacy team here, and we have a large volume of bills to talk about. We've reached that point in the session where deadlines are nearing, activity picking up even more than it has been so far in the sessions. We'll be covering a wide variety of areas. You'll be hearing from Kevin Brinegar, Jason Bierce, Greg Ellis, Adam Berry, Mike Ripley, and Bill Waltz, all working on a variety of issues. We'll start with something that came up a bit of a surprise, caused quite a bit of discussion, and just wrapped up, we believe, for the session late last night or last evening. And Greg Ellis, that was a bill that, again, one of those that seemed pretty benign, but we had an amendment thrown in that was pretty much labeled a moratorium on power plant projects, which would have affected just about everybody. Give the listeners a little idea what happened there and how that ended up playing out to this point.
Sure. A little bit of history. That bill started out as a water bill. It was intended to fix some issues with language and some processes for small and distressed utilities. I won't go into all that detail. We supported the underlying bill. Representative Soliday introduced an amendment to create a task force to study energy and what ways we could change Indiana to make it better. So we supported that as well. He took 3 weeks of testimony on that from different groups. And then the last committee hearing, he introduced an amendment that would create a moratorium on projects of a certain size and basically electric generation. There were two projects in the works at the IURC. It would have killed those. Any of those costs would have been sunk costs that would have been passed on to ratepayers, so everybody would have lost on that, ratepayers and the utilities. He didn't take any testimony on that. It was full speed ahead. It passed out of committee by a vote of 8-4, I think. We had been working with the utilities and our business member, other business members on this, trying to get it killed. It looked like it was going to go full speed ahead. And then yesterday, kind of in an the rare occurrences, Representative Pierce, a Democrat, introduced an amendment to strip out the moratorium language, and that passed out of the amendment passed 5338, essentially killing that moratorium, which is good news for us.
Well, Greg, it's interesting on the subject matter of studying our energy's future, where that bill was at one point, is certainly fascinating and important and something that our Indiana Chamber Foundation may well be pursuing in the near future as that energy landscape shifts, as we move from, we know, most people know, Indiana's strong reliance on coal historically. We're seeing the energy shift to a variety of different sources. So that part's pretty fascinating, but doing it by shutting down immediate projects seemed to be a step pretty far.
Yeah, and I think Representative Hatfield in his debate yesterday said it best that in the past when we did a task force for roads, there was no moratorium that we kept going. And last year when they did the water task force, they didn't prohibit anything from moving forward. So this was kind of an unprecedented move, and there were all kinds of rumors behind it. I don't know that we know all the facts, but I've heard Cole was behind it. I've heard President Trump was behind it. I got a call from the U.S. Chamber yesterday, and we talked about it. They laughed at that, so that's probably not true, but there were a lot of rumors swirling around this one.
Yeah, it certainly is interesting. As we say, several of of our member companies, utilities, are looking at a variety of projects with a variety of different sources. That's kind of the reality of where we are today.
One more thing to add to this. I mean, this was pretty clearly a bad amendment because you had all of the groups that are normally at odds, including the Hoosier Environmental Council. We were all on the same side, and we were all saying this is a bad idea, and it was kind of surprising that it was full speed ahead.
So we often hear that if everybody doesn't quite like something, it's probably pretty good. A good piece of legislation has hit a sweet spot. This is the opposite example of a kind of difficult amendment, difficult piece, because everybody's opposed
right,
to it.
Right.
It was so bad that everybody disliked it. And Tom, this is Kevin. I might mention the follow-up on Greg's comment about the issue, the language appears to be dead for this session. That's because now the bill will move to third reading where it's just a straight up or down vote. And once we hit the deadlines for bills to pass the second house early next week, that language will not have passed either house. And under the rules, unless it were to, I think, end up in the budget bill, language that hasn't passed either house is not eligible to be included in a conference committee report. So that's sort of the backup for what Greg was saying.
So no, we would not be subject to a late, late surprise if indeed it doesn't, that language doesn't pass one of the two houses.
Well, we shouldn't be.
Based
on the rules. But as we've learned from times, occasionally in the past, sometimes the rules are like the Pirates Code. They're just guidelines.
Rules that are made to be bent a little bit. Flexible rules.
Oh.
All right. Thanks, Greg. We'll come back and talk about a couple other issues in the energy environment area also. Kevin, I feel we should kind of put a wrap of a bit on the bias crimes issue. When we had our last call, the legislation had just moved from the Senate to the House. Again, I'm sure many people have followed what played out there. We now have, in a quick, rapid process, we saw House changes, we saw House passage, Senate concurrence, and the governor sign it. But I think it's important for you, if you would, remind the listeners, again, what that language ended up as and why the chamber feels it was a good move as far as getting done what could be done this session.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom. Well, during our last policy call, you said a bill had just come over from the Senate, Senate Bill 12, that was really stripped of all meaningful language that was in the bill when it came out of committee. Essentially only said that judges could consider bias in their sentencing, and that's all it said, very vague and very disappointing to us and other organizations that were pushing for a meaningful bias crime statute, which we felt that the Senate passed version was not. Got to the House, Senate Bill 12 was assigned to Courts and Criminal Code Committee, and it became clear that in that committee the bill was going to be subject to a number of amendments and attempts at gamesmanship. Representative McNamara, who chairs that committee, indicated that there were going to be some over 70 amendments filed to that bill. House Republican majority had internal discussions trying to explore what they could do and what they couldn't do in terms of getting caucus support. And in the end, what they did was take another criminal sentencing bill that also happened to be authored by Senator Mike Bohatchik, who was the author of Senate Bill 12, and that bill was already out of committee and on the floor ready for second reading. And so they jettisoned Senate Bill 12 and put language in Senate Bill 198 that included a reference to a list of characteristics that are in an existing reporting, a bias crimes reporting statute. It is not a complete list, the one that we wanted, but it has a number of specific characteristics. And then in addition, they added the language from Representative Greg Stirwald's House Bill 1093, which is, I call it general language, that says that a judge may also consider a crime, a bias-related crime, on the basis of any characteristic trait, attribute, affiliation, and I think there's a couple other things. So it says that the judge, even though the victim is not on the list in the reporting statute, the judge can still enhance the sentence if a bias crime was committed. I spoke to had face-to-face discussions with two retired Supreme Court Indiana Supreme Court justices, and in both cases I asked them if this language became law, because it hadn't passed yet, do you believe that local judges would use that Stirwald language to enhance the crimes if a bias crime was committed against, say, a transgender person, which is one of the categories that's not in the reporting statute? And in both cases, they said, yes, absolutely. And one of those justices, Frank Sullivan, who is actually a Democrat appointed by Evan Bayh, the day that the bill was passed by the House and signed by the governor, penned a letter to the governor saying that, making that very statement and laying out the rationale for why judges would use that statute. We were put in a difficult position because the bill was not exactly what we wanted. It didn't have a comprehensive list, but in the end, we felt that with the list that was referenced combined with the general language crafted by Representative Stirwald, that and the knowledge from that came to me directly from both Representative Stirwald and Speaker Bosma, that this is as good a bill as they can pass this session. We chose to support the bill, urge passage in the House, and then it went over to the Senate, and they decided, and we kind of expected this, that rather than take the bill to conference committee and try to change it further, that the author just filed a concurrence motion and they voted on the House version, and we urged them to do that as well and urged Governor Holcomb to sign it.
Kevin, the alternative, if this language had not been passed and eventually signed into law, I think it's probably safe to say probably we would have seen no bill. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was this or nothing this year. So we felt that this bill ultimately would be used to protect and enhance penalties, criminal sentences in all categories. And we said at the beginning of the session that we really needed a hate crimes bill passed this year, get this issue in our rearview mirror, and work on other things, because we can't have strikes against us when we're in an intense competition for talent that extends beyond our borders.
And again, as we've mentioned previously, that was one of our key talking points as you testified, as you and Adam both worked on this bill, as you talked with legislators. It is certainly a talent situation, and again, trying to get that message across to individuals that we are in a global competition for individuals to come here and be part of our workforce.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
There's we and again, Adam, Kevin, were in contact with the Anti-Defamation League, one of those keepers of the list, and Adam, I guess I'll ask you to comment briefly, if you would, on that, where it doesn't it appears the standards for getting off the list are a bit of a moving target. A number of states that are included as having a comprehensive bill do not identify gender identity, gender, and some other things. The ADL not inclined to remove us from the list, despite what Kevin said, despite the interpretations that we've heard. But again, it looks, from our perspective, it is a good comprehensive compromise, so to speak.
That's right. Yeah. So at the beginning of the session, you know, the chamber's policy position on this issue was that, one, we wanted a meaningful bias crimes bill that would get us off the list. And the ADL, as the primary keeper of the list, I felt it was important that we be in regular communication with the ADL throughout the process. And I think what it really comes down to is that the ADL, and they emphasized, reemphasized in multiple conversations that in 2019, in order for a state to pass a suitable bias crimes bill, that it needed to be narrowly tailored and cite a comprehensive list of attributes. And so I think where they are currently, and they've not, you know, despite what you might have read, they have actually not come out and said that Indiana will remain on the naughty list. They just have said that Indiana's bill as passed, they can't be supportive of it, in large part because, one, our list that we reference in the statute as passed is not comprehensive, but at the same time, they don't like the broad language that, in fact, makes the list comprehensive. So,
hard to hit, talk about sweet spots, hard to hit that sweet spot.
Exactly, that's exactly right. And so where we came down with Kevin's leadership and we felt like it was more important this year to take more of a pragmatic approach to the issue, to the policy. And as Kevin mentioned, you know, this bill, regardless of what the ADL says, it should in fact get us off the list of states without a bias or hate crimes law, and in practicality, you know, in practice, it will do what it's intended to do. So I think, you know, we've taken the pragmatic approach and feel like we have a fantastic, you know, outcome. Again, not exactly what we wanted. It doesn't, you know, the process wasn't exactly what we wanted, but at the end of the day, I think there's no other position that we in the business community should take other than we have a viable bias crimes bill in the state of Indiana.
And before we leave this topic, we'd be remiss if we did not thank our members, board members, committee members who weighed in on this topic, who contacted our legislators, let them know the importance of this. That was very important throughout the entire process. Some of you on the phone today and many others not. Again, thank you for all of your efforts to help make this a reality. Let's move on to some of the other topics. One of the things in these last 2 weeks of the session people are certainly keeping an eye on is the budget. The Senate passed its version yesterday. Bill Waltz is sitting here with digest of bills and spreadsheets on his iPad. Tell us a little bit about that Senate version and where we go from here in these last couple weeks.
Okay, thanks, Tom. So Kevin might frown on this comment a little bit, but I can't.
Well,
get,
that's a good way to start.
I can't get too excited about the budget at this point. And all I mean by that is, you know, I feel like I could almost write the press release for the House, Senate, or administration budget because it. And this is not a bad thing. They have been so consistently prudent in what they passed for so many years now. They always kind of start, oh, it's balanced budget, you know, maintaining strong reserves. Yes, these are good things, et cetera. So, and I shouldn't diminish that.
So we're not expecting any bad surprises out of what is, again, the one thing that
right,
they
I,
have to do.
I mean,
has that track record.
Yeah, I think.
Very well.
Exactly. You know, these people that I just kind of mentioned there, the three primary players, the administration or Office of Management Budget, the House, and the Senate, are all like-minded, you know, so they have very similar philosophies, they have similar objectives, and
they're all from the same political party.
Yeah, yeah, so they're going to get to the same place. It's not like the old days as I, you know, if I reminisce for a second, when you had, and I know Kevin can relate to this, you had a Democrat-controlled House and Republican-controlled Senate. Well, you were in for some fireworks at the end of the session, and you're just not going to get that and shouldn't expect that. All of the priorities, whatever category you want to get into, they're going to be covered. You know, there's going to be significant K-12 funding. The big projects, you know, are all capital projects of various sorts, workforce grants. They have to spend a lot of money on things that are really not that discretionary. And so I always think it's worth the pie charts that they put out are always kind of fun and good to look at. And they've been right around 50%, as it is exactly this year, of the budget going to K-12 funding. From there, you kind of you hit Medicaid. You know, you have to fund Medicaid obligations. That's another 15%, takes you up to 65. You add the, you know, a lot of discussion this year on the Child Services, Department of Child Services. That's another 12%. I'm trying to follow my own math. Oh, no, you have higher ed in there. That's the 12%. You get up to 77%. Then you have the Child Services, and that's 5%. And you keep going. You know, you get into little slivers of funding at that point. But I always sort of like to take the occasion to remind people that you have a very small sliver for general government. If you look at that pie chart, it's about 4%. You can tack on a few percent here and there for some other ongoing capital projects. But that's the breakdown you get. We're talking of the total dollars is creeping up, you know, as is natural, you know, with growing obligations and expenses every budget. But we're up to $34.6 billion. That's the headline number you see. So I think the focus now, you know, should appropriately be turned to the revenue forecast next Wednesday. Chairman Mishler, when he was presenting the budget yesterday, made a comment sort of suggesting that that number, those total revenue projections, were not likely to change very much. And while it's pretty a secretive process, he is in the position to have a pretty good idea where they're going to come out. So
again, few surprises expected in more volatile economic times, so to speak. With that revenue forecast certainly played a bigger role in the final budget. But again, we don't expect huge changes in what was projected back in December.
No, it's likely to be, you know, I won't even throw a number out there, but if, okay, I will. But, you know, if it's $100 million or less, you know, which is very likely, they'll just have to make, they've probably already got their eye on adjustments, where they spend the money if it's excess or where they cut it if it's not. And so
that'll be minor in the grand scheme of the size of the state budget.
Just like in the Bill Waltz and Kevin Brinegar household budgets, just $100 million is like a rounding error.
Well, not exactly.
Yeah.
Not exactly.
I shouldn't use numbers like that without, thank you, Kevin, putting it in context. Anyway, that's kind of my boring view of the budget.
Thanks, Bill. Just a reminder, those on the phone, any questions, comments you have at any time, simply hit *1 on these or any other General Assembly topics. Let's go back to Adam Barry and talk a little bit about, we've in previous calls, we've talked about economic development package. It not only includes the venture capital tax credit, but some good improvements to some existing tax credits. Tell listeners a little bit about Bill 563.
Yeah, so Senate Bill 563 passed this week out of the House unanimously, 89-0. And as Tom mentioned, you know, the bill, I say it could be renamed as the Small Business Economic Development Bill, because it really it makes tax incentives more accessible to small business owners and adds just more flexibility generally to various tax credits. For example, the redevelopment tax credit allows for the redevelopment of not just abandoned industrial facilities, but now, you know, an old school or you know, a Walmart or whatever the case may be. It just allows for more economic development in a community for facilities that were unable to meet the threshold previously. I think what has a high potential to for it to help a lot of small businesses is what's called the Small Business Innovation Voucher, where participating businesses, and it's limited to small businesses, those with under 150 employees, can apply to the IEDC to leverage the research and development at our public public universities, colleges and universities, to help with technology issues or whatever the business is working on the R&D front, which other states have done with great success. You mentioned the BCI credit. Having the ability, making that transferable is a game changer for that tax credit and for entrepreneurs and startup companies throughout the state who sometimes struggle to raise capital. It now makes foreign capital investment much more possible for these companies. You have the business investment tax credit, which adds more flexibility to companies who are investing in their own machinery and equipment to allow them to benefit from that tax credit. The headquarter relocation tax credit is something that is intended to draw more talent and businesses, especially small businesses, high potential small business to the state. And then not necessarily a tax credit, but the market-based sourcing that will help alleviate some of the tax burdens on our service-based companies in the state will also be add great value to businesses, especially small businesses who are oftentimes double taxed.
On that venture capital side, we'll give our listeners today a little bit of a sneak preview. We have our Indiana Vision 2025 report card coming out in June of this year. We're working with the data right now, getting all that put together. But when you look at venture capital, part of the story is that Indiana at one point fared fairly well after the introduction of our tax credit in the early 2000s, but as that credit was not improved, enhanced, made transferable as it is now, other states passed us by. The ranking has pretty consistently been in the mid-30s in our report card. It is slightly higher as it improved this year, and that's something we can only expect to see more of with this legislation that's passed. Let's turn to another taxation-type issue, this time in the healthcare area. Mike Ripley, one of the priorities, certainly, and probably in our wrap-up call at the end of the month, we'll talk more about the smoking agenda. But on this particular piece of legislation, e-cigarettes, there was some action movement this week as far as the taxation there.
Yeah, Tom. 1444, when it came over from the House, was a 4-cent tax on per milliliter on e-liquids, and after testimony last month, which numerous folks were in support of, including us, there was some discussion that a 4-cent per milliliter tax was difficult to administer. Senator Mishler had promised over the last couple of weeks that he had a plan of action, had a surprise for us, and senators were keeping it pretty close to the vest. I think he got a surprise himself as the way the committee ended up. The bill the amendment that was offered by Senator Holdman and in conjunction with some work from Senator Charbonneau and as well Senator Brown would have taxed e-cigarettes and vapor products at 20% of the retail cost to the seller. It prohibited internet sales of e-cigarettes, e-products. The revenue would have gone to the Children's Health Insurance Program. And then I think the part that actually was the most controversial was offered by Senator Brown, and this was part of her discussion, and that was that CBD oil merchants would have to be registered. Would have to pay a $250 certification, and that money would be used then for the state police to determine the level of THC in the CBD oil. The amended bill, or the amendment, tied 6-6, which I think caught pretty much everybody off guard. All four Democrats voted against it, and Senator Booth and Senator Head opposed it. And it was rather interesting. Senator Mishler continued on with other business, and then they recessed, and lo and behold, came out with an amendment that had not been filed in the committee prior to the hearing, but had been printed up, and I don't know whose it was, but it had a 35% increase, or 35% excise tax on CBD, or on vapor products, did not include the CBD oil language, and did not prohibit internet sales. That amendment was offered, and Senator Talian amended the amendment to drop that 35% excise tax down to 20%, and the amendment passed, and the bill moved out of the committee on a 12-1 vote, with Senator Booth being the only one. He has some commercial convenience stores, and so he would be actually selling the product, and this would be imposed upon some of his business.
So we end up with the 20% excise tax, 20% but not some of those other provisions.
Right. No prohibition on internet sales. The money
and it's
will
passed go, committee. Is it on the Senate floor now?
Yeah, it will go to it'll be on second reading next week, and. It was very interesting, something that I had never seen in the process happen before, that a bill that had not, an amendment that had actually not been filed and brought up. But it was a good move. You knew that it was pretty important to at least many of the senators to move this issue and come up with a tax.
And that's because we are seeing such an increase in that area.
Absolutely.
Of usage. Mike, another taxation-related involved workers' compensation. We've talked about some of the provisions of that bill of benefiting the families of employees who have suffered as a course of an accident, which is very important, but also a tax issue. At one point, there was a tax increase in there, and we were able, with allies, to effectively get that taken care of.
Right. We had anticipated there may be some potential increase in work comp benefits, and then with an offsetting benefit to employers and going after possibly including ambulatory surgical centers in the reimbursement rate that the hospitals are being charged at 200% of Medicare. But those didn't materialize. I think Representative Lehman determined that this just wasn't the right time. It's going to be discussed this summer in a summer study committee. We're going to have discussions about it. Unless it comes up somewhere else, which I can't believe it would, because it was Senator Talian's language, and I can't imagine that she would have enough influence to get that brought that. Put in another bill, and I don't think there will be anything that has any workers' comp benefits left in it. So I think it's dead this year, and we'll at least see a summer study committee on the issue, hopefully.
And that's one of the areas of comprising Indiana's attractive business climate.
Absolutely.
is our workers' comp rates. Jason Beers, let's move on to education area. We've talked a lot in the past about the House Bill 1002, workforce bill. You can certainly touch on that if there's been movement, but I know in the past couple of weeks, accountability has been a key subject, trying to align things a little different with the reality of today's economy. Where does that accountability legislation stand?
It's in pretty good place. It passed out of the Senate Education Committee this week. That's House Bill 1404. It really has two main provisions. One that Tom already alluded to is the accountability part. From our perspective, the most significant part of that. And when we're talking about accountability, we're basically talking about the letter grade system, the A through F system, in terms of what performance grade schools across the state receive. One of the things that we've been working on pretty heavily, starting on the House side, is what are being referred to as post-secondary outcomes. So in addition to the things that typically have been used to grade schools, which are test scores and high school graduation rates, This will include things like what happens to students immediately following high school. Are they graduating with some sort of industry-recognized credential in addition to a diploma, which is happening with greater frequency these days? Are they enrolling in some sort of post-secondary education and training without the need for remediation that's likely going to result in them either taking longer to earn a credential or finish with an additional debt? Or are they pursuing other options like military service that's going to put them on a path to earning a credential? A lot of debate about whether or not how much control schools have over those types of outcomes. I think from our perspective, we think there's a lot that they can do, certainly not on their own, but they are not powerless in helping determine these outcomes. That language is still in the bill. Other piece of this bill that we also supported is providing greater flexibility for schools to offer things like work-based learning and have those experiences satisfy existing high school diploma requirements. There's actually ways that schools can do this already, but I think this was kind of an intentional way to send a signal to schools that they have more flexibility to meet the new graduation pathways requirements as well as the diploma requirements. There were some amendments in committee that affected both these provisions in the bill, but nothing that really gives us any heartburn, just clarifies, you know, what the process will be in terms of approving these alternative courses or experiences and add some additional indicators on the accountability side that the state board could consider when making changes to the school accountability system. You know, one thing that I think sometimes has gotten lost in this debate is that, as a practical matter, the legislature is just sending a signal to the state board of some parameters they would like to see around what changes get made to the school accountability formula, but at the end of the day, it's the members of the State Board of Education that will determine what those changes are, you know, which metrics are weighted more heavily than others, et cetera. But nevertheless, we really think that both of these are worthwhile proposals that will help ensure greater alignment between what our schools are doing and the needs of the workforce. Related to that, Tom mentioned House Bill 1002, which has basically been referred to as the governor's workforce bill. Most of the aspects of it have more to do with career and technical education, primarily at the secondary level. There have been a number of changes to this bill, and I think we'll continue to see changes through the conference committee.
Good changes?
Well, that it's a mixed bag. I think it depends who you ask. One provision that was removed that we had supported was a CTE course requirement for high school students, being that, you know, either an introductory course on a sequence of courses, and what I mean by that is, like, and this is not the best example, but, you know, welding one on a sequence of welding 1, 2, 3 would be one way to satisfy that requirement, or just more of an exploratory introductory course like a preparing for college and careers course. We thought both of those were worthwhile in terms of providing incentive, one, for students to even know what their opportunities are, but two, put them on a path to actually earn something that's going to give them some currency in the marketplace. That has been removed. I think it's fair to say it might appear either in this bill or another bill in conference committee, but for the time being, that is no longer part of the bill. Another change that may or may not be interesting to folks on the phone is changing the composition of the governor's workforce cabinet, which, as you know, is primarily folks from business and industry. This would add 4 legislators, non-voting rights, but legislators nonetheless, the ranking members on the education committees. So we're talking Senator Rotz and Representative Boehning and their ranking minority counterparts from those committees. The governor's office was not very keen on this change. I think from our vantage point, it's not dramatically changing the composition of the cabinet. If we want to be optimistic, it's possible that this might lead to greater coordination and alignment between bills that the legislature introduces and recommendations coming out of the cabinet, but it's to be determined whether that, in fact, shakes out, but from our perspective, we didn't really see that as a problem. Related, in part because it got dumped into the current version of 1002, is a Senate bill, Senate Bill 420 that would have created in its original form what was called industry credentialing organizations. This is a very well-intentioned bill, but there were some aspects of it that we've been trying to work on behind the scenes with staff and legislators from both houses, starting with the name, which is a bit of a misnomer because these organizations would not, in fact, be offering credentials. The name has been changed, and you can
to
argue
protect the innocent.
that it's just as unwieldy a name, but at least it's a little bit greater clarity in terms of what they'll be doing, which is industry collaboration organizations. But you know, setting aside the surface naming, the biggest change here is this started as a tax credit bill. It really was designed to provide an incentive for industry to come together in its original form from across the state, from a single sector, like, say, advanced manufacturing, and if they were to be engaged in helping their local schools build career and technical education programming, provide work-based learning experiences, et cetera, there's a number of things that would be allowable. They would be eligible for a tax credit. Well, that was sort of an unworkable proposal from the beginning because fiscal leaders on both sides signaled that they weren't particularly interested in new tax credits. So, you know, we kind of had this bill, well-intentioned, that would create these groups, but without a tax credit, why would anyone want to be part of these groups or what purpose would they serve? So in its current form, this would, rather than a tax credit, these groups would have access to grant funding through the governor's workforce cabinet, starting with a fund that currently there's $2 million in the budget for career coaching. There's other potential monies that the cabinet might be allocating, but this would, in fact, sort of provide a conduit for distributing that those monies, as well as because these would be 501c3 organizations, they would be eligible to receive state money, but also would provide an avenue for them to pool their local resources from industry for that same purpose. So whether or not this is the ideal solution, at least provides some incentive for employers to be engaged. Beyond that, a lot of discussion about whether or not these entities should be statewide in focus or regional in focus. I think from our vantage point, regional is probably more feasible just because, you know, it's hard to imagine employers from the southern part of the state coming together with their counterparts in the northern part of the state and then determining where they would make their investments in school districts from completely different parts of the state. But the current bill provides the flexibility for either regional or statewide in single sector or multi-sector. You know, we would maintain that multi-sector is probably more advantageous because it ensures some alignment and pooling of resources across different industry. And, you know, there's a lot of overlap in those different industries, too, in terms of the type of workers they're leaving. You know, people with IT credentials aren't just working in the IT sector, but nevertheless, we feel like this bill is at least coming out in a shape that there's potential to provide, one, a little clarity to where the money is that the cabinet might be allocating, where they'll go, and ensuring that industry has a leading seat at the table in that regard. And, you know, if we can play a role in helping industry come alongside local schools to better prepare their students for the needs of the workforce, we're all for that as well. But we'll kind of keep an eye on this one and see how it shakes out in the final calculus.
Jason, you mentioned a couple times the governor's workforce cabinet. Again, another kind of shout out that the chamber members, you are well represented on that by Paul Perkins. He heads up Amatrol in Jeffersonville, leads our chamber workforce development committee, part of our executive committee, really the kind of the go-to person in the state from a business perspective on workforce issues.
Yeah, and you mentioned Paul. Give him a shout-out also for speaking in committee on House Bill 1404, the school accountability bill. We had him as well as Kevin spoke, and John Qualls most recently with the 1150 Coding Academy all spoke from a business community perspective on the importance of aligning the incentives for schools with the needs of employers and the workforce. So really appreciate that kind of support. As important as it is for the chamber to be representing the views of its members with legislators, it's that much more powerful if they can hear it directly from our members. So we really appreciate that support.
One more education issue I wanted to touch on. Teacher pay has certainly been a topic. The various versions of the budget handled a little bit different ways, but primarily I think it's, again, safe to say making additional funds available for local school boards to make those decisions to allocate to teachers. But a bill, again, like so many, that hasn't received a lot of attention that is really pretty interesting is the teacher career ladders.
Sure.
Talk about that a little bit and how that changes the landscape a bit for teachers and offers some opportunities.
Sure. Well, first on the budget bill, I mean, teacher pay is probably one of the issues that's gotten the most attention, at least in the first part of the session, and we've been part of those conversations as well. You know, despite a lot of good intentions, I think the legislators found that just didn't have as much money to work with as they thought with the needs with the Department of Child Services. So we're looking at a pretty modest increase of, you know, maybe 2%, which, you know, Kevin's pointed out, likely is in the ballpark of where it would have ended up even without all the attention on the issue, but you know, lawmakers' hands were tied a bit on this. But, you know, one of the challenges we have, just in addition to there not being enough money for this purpose, is the way it gets allocated. I mean, just in terms of additional tuition support for the school districts. So they actually have a pretty heavy hand in determining how much of that money ends up in teachers' pocketbooks, and there's a lot of variance across the state in terms of how that looks, but which is another bill that has passed would provide some additional reporting to get a better sense of how much of the money is being allocated for educational expenses are actually going in that direction, how much of them are being used for administration and other operational needs. That's a long-winded preamble to then attempt to answer Tom's actual question, which was two bills, really, that have passed through. One, House Bill 1008, teacher career ladders. This is really intended as a way to keep teachers in the classroom longer. You know, as a practical matter, there really isn't, in a traditional setting, much of an opportunity for a teacher to increase his or her compensation beyond just years of service. Other than that, typically what teachers have done is move in administration as a way to increase their compensation. So what this would do would say, as teachers demonstrate their effectiveness and take on additional responsibilities like, say, mentoring younger teachers, et cetera, they could increase their compensation and not be tied strictly to just how many years they've been teaching. Related, another bill, House Bill 1009, would establish what's called a teacher residency grant program, which, in effect, would provide a year-long mentor for new teachers to kind of help them make that adjustment from being college students themselves a few months before to actually being in the classroom. The goal with that being that if you provide more support on the front end, it's going to increase the likelihood that those teachers be retained and they stay in the classroom longer. So in a way, both those bills are really attempting to accomplish much of the same thing. They're just coming about it in slightly different ways. I think widespread appreciation for what the legislature is trying to do in this area, but in both cases, a relatively small amount of money for these two programs, pilot programs, in effect, you know, with the hope that you know, the governor has established a teacher pay commission that they'll be looking at other options to boost teacher pay, but not as much is going to happen as some had hoped coming into this session during this particular budget session. Kevin, I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that.
Yeah, there's one thing I want to add. Within the last week, there was a report that came out, a study from the Rockefeller Institute in upstate New York, which that institute focuses on research on state government policy matters. I'm not sure who the head of it is now, but it used to be headed up by a gentleman named Stephen Gold, who prior to that assignment was the president of NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislatures. And this report looked at the level of average teacher pay increases from 2002 to 2000, I believe it was 16, and unfortunately Indiana was ranked as the lowest increase during that period of time for teacher pays. And this is comes on the heels of a earlier period of time where we were one of the leaders in the country. And so it leads me to conclude that this issue is real, and we're seeing undesirably high levels of turnover among teachers in the first 5 years, and it does appear to be something that the General Assembly, working with the school administrators, needs to address in the coming years.
And we've picked up on some frustration on the part of the legislators because, you know, with few exceptions, they've continued to put more money into schools' budgets. It's just a question of how much of that money actually goes to things like teacher pay, and I think increasingly people are coming to the conclusion that not as much as many of us would like to see.
Kind of gets us back to school efficiency and effectiveness, which is a whole other topic that I'm sure we'll address again.
Absolutely.
I want to come back to Greg Ellis. We talked about various tax issues earlier. Certainly, again, an issue throughout the session has been Indiana Department of Environmental Management and fees. What's taking place with that?
Sure. That's now in House Bill 1278, which is IDEM's omnibus bill. That passed out of the House without any fee provisions. We had been working with the House and the Senate and some other groups on that. The Senate added an amendment to the bill in the Environmental Committee, which passed last week, that would authorize IDEM to change their fees by rule instead of going through the legislative process. Initially, we thought that was a bad idea, and we talked to them about it, and then we saw the spreadsheets of the different fees, and I mean, it would be a nightmare to try to legislate, so a rulemaking is going to be hard enough for them as it is, but we wanted to put some guardrails on what they could do. They came to us, and they said, we need $3.2 million. We haven't raised fees in, I think it was 25 years. The chamber, along with some other groups, agreed to that. Then they came back and said we needed $5.2 million. So we had concerns over that. Essentially, what had happened was Senator Mesmer tried to work a deal, and what he said was he put $4.2 million as the cap on what they could do. There are some other guardrails if this goes into law. They can't raise fees, you know, at their will. They can only do it once every 5 years, and then there's only a 10% increase after this initial go-round. And we'll be involved with the rulemakings. But initially what was out there was they're going to have to start cutting staff, which I think a lot of people think, hey, IDEM cutting staff, that's a good thing. But when it comes to permits for business and them slowing down, which, you know, now I don't think there's a backlog according to the IDEM commissioner, but if we start getting a backlog and you started to have to wait a year or 2 years for a permit, either your business is in trouble or we're not going to get new businesses in those areas.
So bottom line, reasonable permit fee increases are something that we should embrace to help keep IDEM operating smoothly. Water infrastructure, we've talked about water, the legislation to at least get some money into an assistance fund.
Yeah, there was House Bill 1406, which was Representative Soliday's bill, which would put $20 million into the fund that was created 2 years ago. That's not enough money, but it's a start. So, I mean, we supported that. We're happy with that. It's been signed by both the Speaker and the Senate Pro Tem. So that's up to the governor now, which I can't imagine there's a problem with that. So that's a positive thing.
Thanks, Greg. While we've been on this call, news has kind of broken that the Capital Improvement Board here in Indianapolis has reached a deal with the Indiana Pacers to keep the NBA franchise here for a number of years. We bring that 25 years. We bring that up because legislation certainly related to that, and that was one of the key things that had to happen. Kevin, you've been working following that, and again, we talk about the Indiana Pacers. It's not the Indianapolis Pacers. There are statewide impacts in for not only them staying, but this legislation.
Well, absolutely, Tom. This bill is a fairly complicated bill because it not only has language to continue, extend the funding sources that from the state and local revenue sources that provide funding for Bankers Life Fieldhouse and Pacer Sports and Entertainment that operates Bankers Life Fieldhouse. But it also includes, as it came out of the Senate, language to provide funding for expansion of the Indiana Convention Center and two new assistance for two new hotels that would add a total of, I believe it was like 1,400 rooms. And it included language that would allow the Indy 11 soccer team to negotiate with the city of Indianapolis for a project to build not only a soccer stadium, but a retail and residential complex around that, and that would allow them to capture the, I believe it was both sales and income tax revenue generated from that location to put back into the financing of the project. That's a lot of important and complex economic development and tax policy items to put into one bill. So it's not surprising that there were differences between the House and the Senate. But in the end, and then you throw in the fact that by the, when the bill got over to the House, the group of existing hotel owners in downtown Indianapolis began opposing the bill because they felt that the expansion of the convention center was not sufficient to support the expansion of hotel rooms and that occupancy rate throughout downtown and even on the outer ring of Indianapolis would be negatively impacted by that. In the end, as I understand, the amendment coming out of the Ways and Means Committee was to take the public funding out of the expansion of the hotel, of the convention center and the hotels, and so if they wanted, the Capital Improvement Board wants to do that and work with a hotel developer, they'll have to do that with private money. You mentioned the Indiana Pacers being having statewide impact and important to the state as a whole. There's several pieces of evidence in that regard. I think one is their developmental league team is in Fort Wayne, the Fort Wayne Mad Ants, and so there's a connection to another city across the state. They have ticket holders. They testified in all 92 counties, and this is an organization that brings positive attention to our state and a sense of pride. I can tell you I have had the privilege of traveling to Asia with the Pacers for some preseason games, and believe it or not, there is a large Indiana Pacer fan club in Beijing, China. And when the Pacers played there, there was a whole section of the arena of young people, mostly young people, wearing Pacer jerseys. And so it's very much a national and international presence and exposure that this team brings to our state. So we've all along thought this was a very important bill and tried to support it and assist it as it moved along throughout the process.
A couple things quickly before we wrap up, Greg. Also, our lead federal lobbyist, a little bit on some activity taking place in Washington.
Sure. Well, I think right now they're on recess for a couple weeks. But last week I met with Senator Young and his staff when he was here on Monday morning. Some of the issues we talked about were the medical device tax, the export-import bank reauthorization, closure of the border that was threatened, trade and tariff concerns that we continue to hear from our members. I also got a phone call from Representative Hollingsworth's office. They're looking to work with chamber members on financial literacy issues, so that's something to be aware of. I went to a briefing at Ice Miller. They had hosted an international affairs briefing on the Yemen crisis. I think all of the Indiana delegation was represented there, the federal lawmaker staff, and I had some conversations there on some of those same issues that I mentioned before. So don't forget about our federal affairs. If there's questions you guys have, feel free to contact us. Lizzie and I are working on putting together the fall D.C. fly-in, so if you have special requests, there's still time.
I will add in, we released a podcast with Representative Jackie Walorski this week, a conversation we did with her. I encourage you to listen to that. We'll include a link to that in the follow-up email.
This is Kevin. I also met with Senator Young and his staff last Friday afternoon and learned and was there with some other organizations that are part of the Alliance for Healthier Indiana, and learned that Senator Young is planning to co-author federal legislation to raise the legal smoking age from 18 to 21 across the country. 8 states have already done that. We had legislation in our General Assembly to do that that has stalled. And I guess going back then to segueing back to the state issues, I would say this is one area where we have, other than the vaping tax bill that Mike talked about earlier, we have not made progress on either raising the legal age of smoking and vaping or raising the cigarette tax, and particularly the former, I find almost unconscionable that we're not doing that to help prevent thousands of teenagers from becoming lifelong smokers, and it's becoming more and more evident that there is vaping is rampant in our schools, and kids don't realize that they're getting hooked to nicotine.
We will be talking much more about that. In wrapping up, so we're sitting here, again, the legislature has to wrap up its business by April 29th. All indications are that's going to take place a few days early, several reasons. National Rifle Association Convention rolls into Indianapolis April 25th through the 28th, I believe. President Trump will be here in Indianapolis speaking at that convention 2 weeks from today. So indications are the 24th, the 25th. So, Kevin, give a very brief rundown what we're going to see in these only 12 calendar days remaining till then.
Yeah, it's going to be a mad dash. They have deadlines for the amendment, second reading, and then third reading, final passage on the bills in the second house early next week. Then they'll have in those remaining days conference committees where they will work out the differences in bills that between the House and Senate versions of bills that are still alive. We've already seen about a dozen conference committee meetings posted.
Earlier than normal.
Much earlier than normal. Usually you see almost none before the third reading deadline. So that suggests to me that the word has come down from the leadership. If you've got differences between House and Senate passed versions of your bill, you better get them worked out quickly or that bill will be left behind. So I think we're going to see a very intense and fast-paced next 2 weeks, concluding this session, and your chamber lobbying team will be following those bills and trying to make sure the good bills get across the finish line and the bad bills get stalled somewhere if there's any left.
Thank you, Kevin. With that, we will wrap up. Again, you will receive a follow-up email, some links to important chamber information. As I mentioned earlier, we will be back in just about 2.5 weeks, scheduled for Tuesday morning, April 30th, with analysis, break down what happened these last few weeks, and take an overall look at the legislative session. With that, we thank you, as always, for your participation and for your support of the Indiana Chamber. Have a wonderful Friday and weekend.
Thank you. And thank you all for your attention. This concludes today's conference call. All participants may now disconnect.